Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Melanie reading the Big Bend Sentinel on August 27th. Facing pandemic and postal cuts, county officials prepare for hectic election. By Abby Perot and Steve Paulson. Tri-County, the United States Postal Service, and concerns about restructuring and cuts at the agency has been in the news a lot lately. After a chronic budget issues exacerbated by the coronavirus, the Postal Service in April warned that it was facing insolvency. At press time, it's unclear how or whether changes at USPS have affected local residents. USPS did not answer questions about overtime hours and mail volume in Tri-County zip codes. And while the Big Bend Sentinel has filed records requests seeking this information, we have not received any records yet. USPS workers in the region also declined to comment for the story, citing USPS policy. But in interviews with the Big Bend Sentinel, local election officials throughout the region outlined how they were preparing for the challenges of this year's election, including a surge in requests for mail-in ballots. Despite the upheavals, local officials say they're confident that mail-in and absentee ballots won't be lost in the shuffle. And for added peace of mind, they also stress that this year, locals are welcome to submit mail-in ballots in person. Recent changes with the Postal Service have worried many Americans, particularly in rural areas where the post office serves as a lifeline for everything, from receiving medications to sending orders out from small businesses. In Texas, state officials have fought in court to limit vote-by-mail to only older and disabled voters. Since rural areas also skew older than urban ones, postal concerns matter, especially in the Big Bend. Election officials in the Tri-Counties all said they were seeing a higher demand for mail-in ballots this year compared to previous elections. Nora Nussbaum, the elections administrator for Brewster County, has already received nearly 150 more mail-in ballot requests for the general election than she did for the primary, and her office is still months away from the October 23rd deadline to request a mail-in ballot. The very first year I was in here, we had under 300 mail-in requests, Nussbaum said this week. Right now, we have a little over 400. She stressed that requests have to be received by October 23rd, the deadline, not just postmarked by that date. Requests can be dropped off too, she said. To get a mail-in ballot, voters must be registered to vote, with the registration deadline on October 5th this year. In May, President Donald Trump appointed Louis DeJoy as Postmaster General. DeJoy, a polarizing figure with no prior post office experience, has extensive investments in some of USPS's top competitors, including the logistics company XPO, and has been a donor to President Trump's campaigns. On August 7th, DeJoy modified the organizational structure of the USPS in an effort to operate in a more efficient and effective manner, a press release announced. The move pushed out a handful of longtime USPS leaders out, reassigning or replacing 23 executives. Concerns escalated among Congress and U.S. residents as DeJoy's USPS reportedly cut back on overtime hours, starting removing mailboxes throughout the country and followed orders to dismantle mail sorting machines in major mail hubs. I am so concerned about the delays, said Jeannie Mitchell, a member of the regional nonpartisan Tri-County Voter Promoters. Anecdotally, Mitchell said she has already noticed it in mail delivery that I get, so I would encourage people to get those applications in as soon as possible. Make their plans now as if they are going to vote by mail or vote in person, or do it just as quickly as possible, she said. Don't wait till the last minute. Senator John Cornyn denied any issues at the government agency, calling it a non-scandal in a Washington Post op-ed and a conspiracy theory in a TV interview this week. But another Republican representing the Tri-County seemed to disagree. As the U.S. House of Representatives called a special reconvening this summer to address post office concerns, the Tri-County's Congressman Representative Will Hurd voted alongside many Democrats to authorize $25 billion to help the USPS handle the pandemic and upcoming election. USPS provides prescriptions, absentee ballots, cleaning products, birthday cards, a method to pay bills, and so much more to the American people, and they're doing this throughout the pandemic, said Hurd. America's Postal Service is essential, and like always, I will continue to support them. Notably, he also broke from the party line by calling for nationwide mail-in voting for all. We should be making it easier to vote rather than putting up barriers, the statement added. Exercising our civic duty in unprecedented times requires unprecedented measures. The solution is for every state to allow voters to request a mail-in ballot due to COVID-19 health risks, not haphazardly mailing out ballots. Testifying before Congress this week, DeJoy said that he'd pause any further changes to public postal services, but not roll back the existing ones until after the November election. But some experts feared the damage was already done, imperiling the federal government's most popular program. 91% of Americans view the USPS favorably. A Pew poll from April found once again beating out every other federal agency. Despite an increase in expected mail-in ballots, officials in both Presidio and Jeff Davis counties said they were already preparing for the election and were confident they could handle it. I'm not concerned, said Florcita Zubia, a deputy county clerk in Presidio County, who has 4 years helped out with many county elections. She acknowledged that there would be challenges, from more traffic to the fact that the county officials this year would also be helping with Martha's city elections. But said sometimes the news can overemphasize what's actually happening, and in the case of Presidio County, at least, she didn't think there was any cause to be sounding alarms. Zubia encouraged people to call the county if they had any questions and urged residents to vote, whether via mail or in person. The elections office can be reached at 432-729-4081. The way we speak out is through our vote, Zubia added. We have voting machines available, and they're very user-friendly. Carol Truax, the deputy county district clerk in Jeff Davis County, said much the same. While she said Jeff Davis County was also seeing an increase in mail-in ballots, she said adjustments were being made at the state and local levels to cope with any challenges. This year, for example, people can drop off mail-in ballots at the clerk's office, not just on election day, but at any point during early voting. Truax also addressed another concern making the rounds, that people might vote by mail and never know if their ballot was actually counted. Absentee voters can contact the clerk's office at any time to make sure their vote ballot was received, Truax said. And in the case of a ballot that was received but also rejected, she said residents would be contacted by elections officials. Our post office does a really great job, she added. They're very, very good. Still, with added coronavirus precautions this year, she acknowledged that in-person voting this year may take a little longer. Outside of county offices, concerns about the integrity of the Postal Service broke down mostly along party lines. Dan Dunlap, the Republican Party chairperson for Presidio County, said he had no concerns about USPS's ability to handle mail-in ballots. Clark Childers, the Democratic Party chairperson, said that while he was concerned about some of the issues at USPS, he didn't want to feed into the distrust of the USPS and had great faith in our local elections. I encourage everyone to vote in the way they feel most confident, he said. The most important thing is to simply vote. Still, he added that he wished he had more faith in the capabilities of our Postmaster General and that he hoped people will contact their elected officials and throw their support behind USPS, an agency that, he added, employed more than 7 million people overall, including more than 97,000 veterans. And while the post office may not always make money, Childers pointed out that plenty of other government services, including the military, also work that way. The USPS has unique challenges working against it. In 2006, Congress required the USPS to pay upfront for the next 75 years' worth of pensions, an unusual requirement that critics say makes it virtually impossible for the post office to turn a profit. If all the other counties are getting mail-in ballots like I am, the post office is going to be very busy, Nussbaum said. The Brewster County elections official was wary of advising voters how quickly they should return mail-in ballots, though afraid she might say it's a couple of days and then the post office doesn't get it in time. Brewster residents can submit their ballots directly to Nussbaum in person anytime after receiving them in the mail. For Brewster County residents concerned about voting logistics, Nussbaum urged voters to contact her directly at 432-837-6230. In a short social media post this week, the Postal Service, without providing further details, sent a message to mail-in voters. If you plan to vote by mail, the post read, plan ahead. Marfa journalist makes appearance on new Netflix series by Stephen Paulson. United States. A new Netflix series exploring the wellness industry debuted this month, and one prominent local writer makes an appearance. The series, titled Unwell, looks at some of the latest health trends that modern Americans are using to treat what ails them. From fasting and ayahuasca to bee sting therapy. The first episode looks at essential oils, chemicals that have long been used for applications like perfumes, but which in recent years have taken on a new life for use in alternative health treatments. It's a topic that Rachel Monroe, a freelance journalist based in Marfa, knows well. In 2017, she wrote a long-form story on the products for The New Yorker, questioning whether their appeal came down to medicine or marketing. Monroe served as a paid consultant for the episode, helping connect the producers to sources and otherwise offering expertise. She also makes a couple cameos where she talks about her reporting and offers context on some of the big players in the industry, including Donald Gray Young, an enigmatic and polarizing figure who ran one of the largest essential oil companies until his death in 2018. Essential oils are a contentious subject. On one hand, a couple limited studies have shown the effectiveness of some oils, including the ability of lavender oil to treat anxiety. Countless Americans swear by them as tools for relaxation and to improve well-being. On the other hand, some essential oil boosters have gone much further, advertising the products as, for example, a cure for cancer. And the business behind essential oils does little to tamp down the controversy. Just two companies, doTERRA and Young Living, dominate the essential oils market. And both are multi-level marketing companies, a controversial business model in which salespeople earn based not just on products they sell, but on the people they recruit to join the company. In an interview on Tuesday, Monroe said she got curious about essential oils around 2015 when she started noticing them everywhere. More intriguing still, the products seem to have a broad-based appeal across all kinds of disparate subcultures. The interest in the oils crossed demographic lines, reaching people you wouldn't think would necessarily share the same interests, Monroe said. Those included some not-so-surprising groups, like hippies and my wellness yoga studio friends, Monroe said. On the other hand, there was also a strong Christian component to it and kind of overlaps with the anti-vaccine world. Assessing the validity of people's personal wellness rituals can be like walking into a minefield. And in both Monroe's original story and in the Netflix series, the reader is left to reach their own conclusions about whether essential oil advocates are right or wrong. I'm not a science journalist, Monroe said in her interview. I'm not qualified to tell anybody what's real or fake. And when it comes to science behind essential oils, she stresses, there is some research. It's not all made up. Still, aspects of the essential oil world did set off alarm bells for Monroe. For one thing, while she thinks many people are turned off by mainstream healthcare and the pharmaceutical industry for very understandable reasons, she also thinks that out of the mainstream, health solutions, almost by design, offer an opening for charlatans and hucksters. Though she stresses that she doesn't want to paint with a hugely broad brush. Then, there's the fact that many essential oils are sold through multi-level marketing companies. That's the thing that I feel on firmer ground critiquing, she said. What I feel comfortable saying is, I feel very skeptical of MLM or network marketing as a form of business, she adds. After all, multi-level marketing companies are often characterized by overpromises and talk about miraculous solutions, and even people in that structure fall prey to some of its incentives. For Monroe, who typically sticks to the written word, consulting on a TV show was an interesting experience. She recalled how she was interviewed in a random apartment in Williamsburg, a set she thinks was meant to give the illusion that it was her home. And when producers first called to discuss the project, she started eagerly talking about the subject she loves, only to stop herself once she realized she was giving away insights to a for-profit venture for free. Her advice to other writers who find themselves in that position, it's good to stand up for yourself and make sure you understand who is asking you for what. So where does Monroe personally stand on essential oils? I don't really use them for medicinal purposes, she said. I've never ingested them, and I never would ingest them. Still, she adds, some of them definitely smell good. She sometimes uses an essential oil diffuser as an air freshener, and I like to make my own cleaning supplies. But overall, she says, her interest in the products is more the aroma than the aromatherapy. Coronavirus, live updates for the Big Bend region by Abby Perot and Stephen Paulson. Last updated, September 2nd, 5:46 p.m. The Department of State Health Services has reported a fifth death in Presidio County. No further details have been provided at this time. From the governor, Texans are expected to wear a face covering over their nose and mouth when inside a commercial entity, building, or space open to the public, and in outdoor spaces where maintaining 6 feet of distance from others is not possible. The latest testing data from the Texas Department of State Health Services. Presidio County, 66 positive, 43 recovered, 5 deaths. Brewster County, 203, 183 recovered, 2 deaths. The county is reporting 206 cases, 203 recoveries, 2 deaths. Jeff Davis County, 13 positive, 8 recovered. At least 12,870 Texans have died from the virus. 621,667 have tested positive for COVID-19, and around 5.07 million tests have been conducted across the state. We are staying in regular contact with health authorities, schools, businesses, and other officials, and will update regularly with timestamps for time-sensitive updates. Nearby counties' case counts. El Paso, 20,611. Hudspeth, 39. Culberson, 35. Reeves, 172, Pecos, 303, Terrell, 3, Crane, 71, Ector, 2,852, and Midland, 3,272. Marfa Live Arts presents Radio Plays in the Time of Corona by the Big Bend Sentinel, September 2nd, 2020. Marfa. Marfa Live Arts, in association with KMKB, presents Radio Plays in the Time of Corona, 4 radio plays written by Marfa High School playwrights and professionally produced, scored, and brought to life by voiceover actors. The award-winning short horn playwrights who will have their work produced as a radio play are Aubrey Aguilar, Febby Brimhall, Devin Meerhoff, and Avery Beltran, class of 2020. Radio Plays in the Time of Corona premieres on Marfa Public Radio 93.5 FM and online at marfapublicradio.org at noon on Friday, September 18th, and again on Wednesday, September 23rd at 10 p.m. The plays will air again on KMKB 98.9 FM, kmkb.org, over the weekend of September 19th through the 20th, broadcasting both Saturday and Sunday at noon and 6 p.m. The plays were written by Marfa High School students during the 9th playwriting program hosted by Marfa Live Arts and taught by New York playwright Caridad Spitch. Usually the winning student plays are brought to life with adult actors for the community at the Crowley Theater in Marfa. However, due to COVID-19, the plays were unable to be staged. Making lemonade out of pandemic lemons, Marfa Live Arts decided to adapt and to instead produced radio plays in the time of Corona in order to showcase these young playwrights' words. Learn more at marfaliveArts.org.
Hello, this is Sonia reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, September 3rd, 2020. City purchases Entertainment Plaza for $1.2 million. City to Create Citizens Board for Input by Sandra Sadek. The City of Fort Stockton has decided to move forward with the purchase of an entertainment complex from Stockton Plaza LP on August 28 for a closing price of $1.2 million with hopes of repurposing the space to attract visitors. The property located at 2181 IH-10 houses Stockton's Entertainment, a movie theater and bowling alley now permanently closed since 2018 after a series of unsuccessful ownerships, and has been on sale for 2 years. The city is working on putting together a citizens committee to help identify city needs and receive feedback on the project ideas for the property. Property plans. While there have been talks of potentially converting the bowling alley into a convention hall and the mini golf park into a concert venue, City Manager Frank Rodriguez said nothing has been set in stone and it could take months before solid plans and blueprints are drafted. Everyone has ideas, but our plan was to get a committee together and get some feedback to see what would be feasible. And when it comes to finances, we want to be smarter in what we do and how we go about doing it, because historically, what was there before, based on the finances, it failed in some form or fashion, Rodriguez said. Our goal is to make it beneficial for the community. Rodriguez said the city is hoping to keep the theater and snack bar operational so that residents have an entertainment venue. Negotiations for the purchase of the property began in July 2019. The $1.2 million purchase, originally on sale for $2.5 million, will be funded using mostly money from the Convention and Visitors Bureau hotel motel taxes, as well as some funds from the Economic Development Council's sales taxes. Anything that will promote tourism and conventions near the hotels. We're trying to get individuals who are coming into our town to stay in our hotels and tour our sites. It has great access to numerous hotels within walking distance, said Mayor Chris Alexander. Stockton's Entertainment was first designed in 2002 by Malone and Amy Mitchell. The project took 2 years to complete and cost over $5 million. However, in 2016, the Mitchells left Fort Stockton and the entertainment complex remained abandoned for months until a couple from Odessa, John and Joe Burns, decided to purchase and revamp the plaza. Unfortunately, the plaza closed down again in 2018 and has remained unoccupied since then. Funding limitations. Because of the nature of the funding, the city is limited on how the property will be refurbished under the Texas Tax Code, Title III, Subtitle B, Chapter 351. According to the code, the tax revenue can only be used to promote tourism and the convention and hotel industry. Its use is limited to the acquisition of sites for and the construction, improvement, enlarging, equipping, repairing, operation, and maintenance of convention center facilities or visitor information centers, or both. The furnishing of facilities, personnel, and materials for the registration of convention delegates or registrants, among other things. Now, because of COVID-19, you're very restricted in what you can do. A lot of people aren't going to the bigger cities, they're staying home, Rodriguez said. So, in my opinion, I think now's a good time to have something closer to home so you're not having to travel and go out of town. Depending on what is decided for the future of the property, any remodeling to be done on the property or any staffing needs would be included in the CVB's budget and would be decided by the CVB. Next steps. The city now has 45 days to close the deal with the seller. Once the deal is closed, bids will open for the city to hire engineers and architects to help draft up plans alongside the input of the Citizens Committee, which would also be created from volunteers during that time. Once plans are drafted, work on the property can be expected to start. Depending on what is decided for the property, the timeline of the project could last several months, said Rodriguez. Fire breaks out south of Ira Ann. No immediate danger to city, by Sandra Sadek. Fire crews are battling a fire that broke out in Smith Canyon, about 4 miles south of Ira Ann, on August 31st following a lightning strike. According to the Texas A&M Forest Service, the fire is currently 15% contained and has spread to an estimated 11,000 acres. The fire can also be seen from Highway 349 and IH-10, and the Ira Ann Sheffield Fire Department urges caution. While there is no direct danger to the city of Ira Ann, two residential structures near the fire are being monitored as well as oil-filled equipment in the area. We have two structures that we are doing structure protection on, said Ira Ann Sheffield Fire Department Chief Troy Sparks. But the biggest thing right now is going to be mitigating the fire around the two structures. Heavy aircraft tankers were ordered from Arizona and New Mexico on Tuesday to assist with fire mitigation, with approval from the Texas Department of Public Safety, and arrived on the scene Tuesday and Wednesday. The Texas A&M Forest Service has also been on the scene to help contain the fire and has set up a command post at the Kinder Morgan Recreation Center. Residents are asked to be cautious when driving to the golf course or park and while heading out of town near the Kinder Morgan offices. Residents are also asked to refrain from asking direct questions to personnel in the area. This is a developing story. The Fort Stockton Pioneer will continue to update this story as more information becomes available. County active cases on the rise. After a small spike over the weekend and a short-lived decrease throughout the week, the number of active COVID-19 cases in Pecos County is back up to 32 as of September 1st. As of Tuesday, there has been a total of 1,803 individuals tested. 1,494 have tested negative, and 221 have tested positive. There are still 23 pending tests, and the number of fatalities has remained at 5. There have been 184 recoveries. Mandates are still in place requiring all Pecos County residents to wear a mask while out in public and limiting all gatherings to 10 people or less. FSISD School Board approves interlocal SRO agreement. Student attendance continues to increase. By Nathan Hewer. The Fort Stockton ISD School Board unanimously approved the contract between the City of Fort Stockton and FSISD during the board's monthly meeting on August 31st, after a delay in voting on the interlocal agreement for school resource officers. The board approved the contract via a 6-0 vote. Board member Sandra Rivera was absent from the meeting. Superintendent Ralph Trainum stated one of the final hurdles for the agreement was compensation for the officers, and cost was agreed upon during Monday's meeting for an amount of $52,750.25. The figure is for 175 9-hour workdays by up to 5 officers. The dollar figure translates to a daily cost of $301.43. Additional costs for training requirements will be covered by the school district, including pay registration and travel accommodations for any training encouraged by the district. Expenses pertaining to other training needed or desired by the school resource office would be paid for by the city. Duties of the school resource officer, as requested by the district administration, encompass investigations, crowd control, issuing citations, traffic enforcement, making both juvenile and adult arrests, as well as any enforcement of violations pertaining to and under the authority of the Texas Penal Code and the Texas Education Code within the scope and limits of such laws, and other duties as may be described in the district's SRO job description. Campus student attendance. An update was given on the attendance of students in the school district. Out of 2,365 students in the district, 946 were on campus on Monday, August 31st. That was an increase of 104 students, a 4% increase compared to the previous Friday. Trainum said the increase was partially due to progress reports that came out last week. I do know some parents that sent off kids to school because they were not logging in like they should have throughout the month of August. They were getting behind, and progress reports went out last week. So, some parents are sending them off to school since they were getting behind at home, he said. As more students return to school, more classrooms will be open to allow for appropriate distancing. Trainum added he is not worried about a large number of students returning to campuses at any given time, as the school district could have all 2,365 students return to school in person while maintaining appropriate distancing. As they do come in, we'll utilize more classrooms, he said. But going by our survey we did over the summer, unless things change, we'll be looking at 50% of our student body returning to campus. In other action, the school board approved an order authorizing the defeasance and redemption of a portion of the Fort Stockton ISD Unlimited Tax School Building Bond, Series 2014, approved the General Fund, Food Service, and Debt Service Budget, which includes the district contribution of $386 a month per eligible employee participating in TRS Active Care and TRS Care Health Insurance, approved the total tax rate of $0.0663, a decrease from last year, said there will be 30 tickets allowed per team for indoor sporting events for the athletes to take home so their parents or family can come to the game. After each game, gymnasiums will be cleared out before the new group can come in to watch the next game. Purchased Presence Learning, which provides supplemental support for students receiving speech therapy, was approved. The cost is $59,200 and will be paid by way of a federal grant.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading for the Monahans News on September 3, 2020. Here are some obituaries that appeared in that edition. Mary Ann Johnson, age 79, of Monahans, passed away suddenly in Odessa on August 25th. She was born in Logan, West Virginia, to George and Margie Jeffrey Molnar on August 11, 1941, the third of nine children. Anne spent her childhood and teenage years growing up in Logan, where she attended school and graduated in 1959. In her 20s, her family moved to Amarillo, where Anne took a job at Northwest Texas Hospital as a nurse's aide. While there, she met the love of her life, Wayne Johnson, who was working as an orderly at the time. The two married on June 18, 1963 in Amarillo and spent 46 years together until his passing in December 2009. She is preceded in death by her husband, Wayne, her parents, and four siblings, and her beloved pet, Sherlock. Anne is survived by sons Dewey of Monahans, David of China Springs, daughter Dara Gail Hogg, and late husband George H. Hogg of Monahans, brothers Bill Molnar of Canton, Don Molnar of Fay, Oklahoma, sisters Gloria Ewing of Amarillo, and Helen Molnar of Tyler, 14 grandchildren and 16 great-grandchildren. Services were held on August 29th at Cornerstone Church in Monahans with Pastor Stan Hufty officiating. A private burial will be held at a later date at Monahans Memorial Cemetery. It is with great sadness to announce the passing of John Marie Cooper Brandenburg. John was born to Otha Lee Cooper and Grace Lee Ellison Cooper in Wichita Falls, Texas, on May 30, 1940. She was the fifth of seven children. She married Robert Brandenburg on May 31, 1960, and had four children. John is preceded in death by her parents, as well as her husband Bob, brothers Roy, Samuel, Charles, sisters Billy Joe and June, and great-great-granddaughter Emberly. She is survived by her brother Ray and wife Tatiana, her children Robbie and wife Polly of Timberin, New Mexico, Dell of Grand Falls, Gilly of Midland, and John of Kenai, Alaska. She also leaves behind 14 grandchildren, 35 great-grandchildren. Fernando Ornelas Acosta, age 75, passed away August 31st in Pecos. He was born December 30th, 1944 in Grand Falls to Julio and Anita Acosta. He is survived by his wife Connie of Monahans, daughter Summer Acosta of Monahans, son Fernie Acosta of Burleson, Christopher Acosta, also of Monahans, along with his pride and joy, his three grandchildren, along with many other grandchildren and family. Rose Helene Russell Byron. It is not how long the flower blooms, but how beautifully. Rose lived beautifully all of her life here on this earth, but went home to be with her Heavenly Father and Lord and Savior Jesus Christ on August 26. She will be forever cherished and remembered by the love of her life and husband of 56 years, James Skip Byron, and her children and their families, Berkeley Helene, Siggy, Zane, and Ava Rose Swanso, Laura, Chris, Ella Rose, and Ty Slodick, Angel Rose, Austin, Aria Rose, and Adlin Rose Edwards, and Jonathan Byron. Rose will be dearly missed by her sister and brother, Marvelyn Russell White and John Russell. She is predeceased by her loving mother and dearest friend, Ada Russell Roach, and father, Marvin Russell. Memorial service is pending. Condolences are welcomed and may be sent to Angel Edwards and Skip Byron, 204 Bella Cima Drive, Lakeway, Texas, 78734. Doris Lee Poteet Greenfield, age 89, of Snyder, died on Saturday, August 29th in Snyder. Doris was born in San Diego, California, to Frank and Mary Poteet on April 10th, 1931. She married Johnny Greenfield on January 9th, 1954, in Lakeside, California, and moved to Snyder, where they shared 66 years together. She was employed as the bookkeeper for Thompson's Shoe Store for almost 40 years, where she also worked as a sales clerk. Doris is preceded in death by her parents, Frank and Mary Poteet, and her brother, Herbert Poteet. She is survived by her husband, Sonny Greenfield of Snyder, son Charlie Greenfield and wife, Vicky of Monahans, daughter Vicky Greenfield of Snyder, and son Mike Greenfield and wife Patty of Abilene. She is also survived by 8 grandchildren and 11 great-grandchildren. A memorial service was held on Tuesday, September 1st, at Colonial Hill Baptist Church under the direction of Bell Seibert Seal Funeral Home following the private burial. In lieu of flowers, contributions may be made to the Scurry County Ministerial Alliance food cupboard. John Charles Bose, age 86, died August 14th in Midland, following several years of declining health. He was the only child of Lucille Romans Bose and Dalton Teal Bose, born February 12, 1934, in Yoakum, Texas. His parents predeceased him. Mr. Bose spent most of his adult life in the Permian Basin area, working in insurance sales and customer service. He was an active member of St. Stephen's Catholic Parish in Midland. He married Beverly June Beard of San Angelo in 1962. Their two children, Michael Dayton Bose and Tracy Michelle Bose Smith, both of Houston, survive him. Other survivors include his former wife and her husband, Beverly and David Baldwin of Friendswood. Besides his parents, Mr. Bose also is predeceased by Jay Smith, his son-in-law. Cremation is under the direction of Yellow Rose Cremation. No formal services are planned at this time. Longtime Monahans High School drama teacher passes away at the age of 68. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Evelyn Rogene Jones, beloved drama and English teacher with Monahans Wicket Pyote ISD for 26 years, passed away suddenly on August 31st in Monahans at the age of 68. She was born on October 8, 1951, in Albuquerque, New Mexico, to Ralph and Doris Jones. Evelyn's father was a weatherman and Church of Christ preacher, so the family moved around a lot during her childhood. From a young age, Evelyn knew she had a passion for directing, even gathering up her neighborhood and church friends to put on skits. One time, Evelyn played dead in the middle of the street. It was so convincing, several passers-by stopped to make sure she was all right. She attended and graduated from Osceola High School in 1969 in Osceola, Alaska. After graduation, Evelyn attended Lubbock Christian College, where she earned her Bachelor of Arts in Education degree. While in school in Lubbock, she was active in the Lubbock Christian College Choir and the Elite Ensemble. Evelyn had an exceptional second alto voice and could even sing first tenor. After her college graduation, she moved to San Angelo and began taking classes at Angelo State University, as well as working in retail, which she absolutely hated. One of her professors at the university saw her potential for theater, where he put her to work running the tech for the plays for the school, building sets, adjusting lights, and directing. It was then Evelyn decided retail was not for her and obtained her Master's of Art degree in theater in 1981. While in San Angelo, Evelyn helped run Angelo Community Theater and managed the Angelo State University Box Theater on campus, which was a place she loved. She also directed some of the plays at the theater. After graduation from Angelo State University, she applied for a teaching job at Monahans High School. Evelyn was hired and moved to Monahans in 1981. She was hired to teach English and develop the drama and speech program at Monahans High School, as well as direct the one-act play. For the majority of her teaching career, Evelyn's one-act play and speech students advanced in district. Evelyn had a passion and an eye for seeing the potential in her students. She had the ability to get the best out of them, which had a lifelong impact on many of her students. In 1987, and with the help of friend Bruce Dillon, Evelyn wrote a play called This West Texas Country, which she also directed in Monahans, as well as in Australia. During her time at the school, Evelyn collected a basement full of beautiful costumes, which was also something she had an eye for, and designed a course called Visual Arts and Media, which explored different genres of movies. She took her theater students on numerous trips to New York City, where they were able to tour the city and attend Broadway plays. Evelyn loved to watch Broadway plays and watch how the plays inspired her direction and set designs for the one-act play. One summer, Evelyn lived in Spanish Harlem in New York, where she worked a ticket booth for an off-Broadway play. Evelyn enjoyed being involved in community theater and children's theater throughout her life, directing such plays as Annie and Oliver, where she played the Pretzel Man. Evelyn retired in May 2007, following 26 years of teaching English and drama at Monahans High School. After retirement, Evelyn stayed active by helping critique and suggest plays for the Monahans High School one-act play for directors who followed her. She was also directing for the Sandhills Civic Theater in Wicket until she was no longer able to physically. She was also active with the First Baptist Church's Children's Choir and Adult Choir, where she was a longtime member. Evelyn also enjoyed being a member of the Singing Women of the Permian Basin, where she also served as president. She wrote a play for one act called The Yellow Silk Rose, which her students performed and advanced to district. Evelyn hailed this as one of her proudest moments. Loving to write, in 2009, Evelyn joined the staff of the Monahans News as a part-time reporter. During her time with the news, she wrote several features on locals and enjoyed writing the Student and Teacher of the Week featurettes. Evelyn will be loved and missed by the many students she inspired over the years and the many friends who were lucky enough to call her family. She was preceded in death by her parents and brother-in-law, Leo Gonzalez. Evelyn is survived by one sister, Linda Gonzalez of Florida, one brother, Jimmy Jones of California, as well as several nieces and nephews. A public memorial will be held at 10 a.m. on September 19th at the First Baptist Church, with Dr. Chris Powell officiating. Attendees are asked to please wear a face mask. MEDC Board makes quick work of short agenda. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. The Monahans Economic Development Corporation, MEDC, Board of Directors, met for a special meeting last Thursday for a relatively short agenda, addressing items such as a tri-party agreement with MEDC, American Momentum Bank, and 828 Car Wash, approving scope of services with Maverick Engineering, and approving meeting minutes. First on the agenda was a tri-party agreement with MEDC, A20 Car Wash, and American Momentum Bank. Director Ashley Adalto said, quote, "This is a subordination agreement with a right to purchase, which is basically the same agreement we had with Staybridge. The agreement will allow 828 Car Wash to get their construction loan. The agreement will give the bank first right of the property if anything should happen, and we will have the second option to buy it back," end quote. The agreement also has an extended extension of 250 days to lay slab because the construction loan is 210 days. Quote, "The bank did ask if MEDC would release our option, but I thought that going this route would be in our best interest, and we still have a right to buy the property back," she said. Shelley Porras, owner of Fitness 828 and Victory 828 Trucking, bought the land on 15th Street last October for $80,000 from MEDC. The plan for the land is to build a full-service car wash similar in design to the Apex Car Wash in Odessa and Midland. Employees will meet you and greet the driver. The wash will feature a tunnel and conveyor design with 75-foot tunnels and vacuums. The facility will be fully staffed from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. daily and employ 8 full-time employees. The agreement was approved. In other business, the board approved a scope of services agreement for additional engineering services for East Monahans Parkway, 15th Street to Business 20, with Maverick Engineering. Quote, "The agreement is for a total of $23,900 and will cover the remainder of the engineering services for Parkway," Adalto said. Included in the cost is pre-construction engineering services, resident project representative services, and construction administration services. In final actionable items, minutes of the August 14th meeting were approved. Directors present were Brian Franks, Richard Irwin, and Camilla Blum. Larry Bryant and Oscar Fuentes were absent. COVID-19 cases up to 6. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. As of Wednesday morning, there were 6 active cases of the COVID-19 virus, according to Ward County Judge Greg Holly. A total of 818 tests have been administered in the county, with a total of 108 cases, 102 recovered, 1 death. There are 12 tests pending. There is no general requirement to wear a mask in Ward County. There has never been any local requirement, and we are now exempt again from the governor's order. Quote, "As of Tuesday, Ward County is again exempt from the governor's mask mandate. Of course, private businesses are free to require masks if they so choose. And many organizations are required to enforce them due to regulatory requirements such as schools, courts, nursing homes, barbershops, and salons, so forth," Holly said. Quote, "The person best able to make decisions for you is the person in your mirror. Stay educated and make decisions you determine best for you and your family. And be tolerant of those who may decide differently than you," he added. Zavala pleads guilty to stabbing, sentenced to 8 years probation. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. A 22-year-old Monahans man was sentenced Tuesday to serve 8 years on probation and pay a $1,500 fine in connection with events surrounding a stabbing which occurred last May. Sergio Zavala of 806 South Harry Street pleaded guilty in front of Judge Mike Swanson in the 143rd Judicial District Court to aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, a second-degree felony. District Attorney Randy Reynolds presented to the court that on or about May 6, 2019, Zavala did intentionally cause bodily injury to Abraham Moreno, stabbing him in the thigh, and used a deadly weapon, a knife, during the offense. Zavala was further ordered to pay a $359 in court costs. He was represented by Parker Johnson, and Randall W. Reynolds was the attorney for the state. Life-saving equipment donated to Ward County Sheriff's Office and Monahan's Volunteer Fire Department. The Permian Road Safety Coalition, PRSC, Noble Energy, and SWEPILP Shell together contributed $260,000 to purchase life-saving emergency response equipment and training for the Ward County Sheriff's Office, Monahan's Volunteer Fire Department, and other rural first responders in the Permian Basin region of West Texas. Quote, "We are very thankful and appreciate this generous donation. Having this life-saving equipment on hand and readily available for our deputies will be a huge asset to our department as emergency situations arise, whether it be an accident or at the schools in Grand Falls," Ward County Sheriff Frerin Valle said. The department received over $60,000 in donated equipment, four sets of Pelican remote lighting systems, power flares, H2S monitors, and Hurst battery-operated jaws of life. Quote, "Barstow Fire Chief Lieutenant Alex Luna will keep us set with him at all times, as will the Grand Falls resident deputy D.C. Lance. Lieutenant Michael Garcia will keep one set with him here in Monahans, and the other will remain at the department. When emergencies happen, sheriff's office deputies are generally the first on the scene, so it will be a huge benefit having our deputies equipped to handle whatever situation they are thrown into," Valle said. As the oil and gas industry's activities have increased throughout the Delaware Basin, a geologic formation that is being developed by industry within the Permian Basin region, there has been a strain on local emergency services and the infrastructure of first responders throughout the region. First responding agencies, many of whom are staffed by volunteers, have limited infrastructure and resources designed to support small populations of less than 10,000. Today, responders sometimes travel over an hour by road to respond to calls for assistance. Increased call volumes, coupled with longer response times, has the potential to delay delivery of emergency services, including the delivery of critical emergency response tools to the scenes of accidents and emergencies. Through this contribution, emergency equipment, such as battery-powered rescue tools, jaws of life, fire extinguisher and rescue helicopter landing zone kits, and related training will be provided to first-on-scene responders and/or pre-positioned closer to remote areas. Quote, "Noble Energy is proud to work in West Texas, and we salute the daily heroic efforts of our first responders throughout the basin," said David Berger, Vice President, Texas Operations for Noble Energy, and a member of the PRSC Board of Directors and Treasurer. Quote, "We are pleased to provide equipment and training to our first responders, but more importantly, to let them know that we support the life-saving work that they do," end quote. For the past 2 years, almost 100 Delaware Basin emergency first responders have been working with the oil and gas industry to identify gaps in service areas, equipment, and training, as well as to better understand industry activities and growth plans. This work has led to a set of recommendations called the Delaware Basin Emergency Prepared Initiative, DBEPI, which includes recommendations for fire services, emergency medical services, law enforcement, and 911 communications and infrastructure. This $260,000 donation is in direct response to the DBEPI recommendations. In 2019, the Permian Road Safety Coalition became the lead nonprofit agency to raise funding for the DBEPI initiative and to help coordinate the distribution of equipment based on the DBEPI recommendations. Scott Scheffler, executive director of the PRSC, said, quote, "The DBEPI recommendations place critical emergency response equipment and training in the hands of first responders that will, in turn, have the potential to save lives in rural areas of the Permian Basin. This donation, while significant, only scratches the surface of the needs of first responders that service more than 20 rural counties throughout the Permian Basin in Texas and southeast New Mexico, many of which are rural locations far from the city centers and emergency response infrastructure. Shell is honored to be part of the DBEPI, which helps make the Delaware Basin a safer place to live and work," said Amir Gerges, Vice President Permian for Shell and a member of the PRSC Board of Directors. Quote, "We heard the community's concerns around road safety and worked through DBEPI to build emergency responders' capacity and through the PRSC to improve driving behaviors and road infrastructure in the Delaware Basin. We thank all of the first responders and local government officials for their daily contributions to the basin," end quote. The PRSC will continue to work with first responders and local government leaders throughout the basin in 2020 to raise additional funding to help provide the tools and training needed in the rural working areas of the Permian Basin.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.